Time to do something else.
Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Education and General Government. It is good to see familiar faces up here and out there. We will start with a minor housekeeping issue and look at our committee rules and perhaps even adopt them.
Mr. Chair.
Should we open an organizational meeting?
That would be a good idea, too.
Open the organizational meeting to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2009.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2009. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. We have a series of reports and informational items to come before the committee. Some we looked into last session, some or all we will be looking into the next two sessions.
Yeah.
All right. And just about ready to do that.
Okay.
Let me close the organizational meeting. And let's start today with an informational meeting on the federal race to the top funding. We have three people who are signed up to testify, perhaps even more, Vicki Fleming, Margie Lowe, and Kate Richardson. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Who would like to begin? And why don't we all go through what you have, and we'll do questions at the end.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Margie Lau. I'm Education Policy Advisor for the Governor. And with me this morning is Vicki Fleming, who is the Design Team Chair for the Race to the Top proposal from Oregon, as well as the Superintendent of Public Schools in Redmond. And along with us is Kate Richardson, who works on the federal stimulus programs, also in the Office of the Governor. So we've kind of divided up the presentation based on our areas of expertise, and we'd be glad to answer your questions when we're finished.
Good morning. Again, this is Kate Richardson. I'm with the Governor's Economic Recovery Executive Team, and I'm the Program Manager working with Education and Workforce. So just as by way of background, you know most of this, but very briefly, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or commonly called the Recovery Act, was passed February 17th, and it dedicated $787 billion to recovery and stimulus across the country. And that amount was divided roughly into thirds. $288 billion went toward tax benefits. $224 billion went to entitlements such as Medicaid, student loans. And $275 billion went to contracts, grants, and loans. Education support and reform is a high priority with the Recovery Act, and more than $90 billion is going toward education. Nearly $10 billion of that is going toward competitive grants. And you'll see on the screen or in a handout? Maybe not.
We have
the screen's not working.
Okay, you have the handout. So the first pie chart you see there is the competitive grants, almost $10 billion. In competitive grants from the U.S. Department of Education through the Recovery Act. And the Race to the Top is a very significant portion of that at $4.35 billion. There are two, and going on to your next page then, there are two threshold criteria for that competitive grant. This grant is for states. The states are the applicant. And the two threshold criteria are that the state must have its, both phases of its state fiscal stabilization fund applications turned in and approved. And as you know, Oregon has already done that for the 84% of our state fiscal stabilization fund allocation. And the next phase will be due. The final requirements haven't been published yet, but it will be due later in this calendar year, and we are already working on preparing for that. So that's one threshold criteria, and the other threshold criteria for states is that they can't have any statutory or regulatory barriers in linking student performance data to teachers for evaluation of teachers and principals. And we have identified that Oregon does not. So this competition is for states only. I think there was it was not clear right away how many states really would be going for this, but you know, you have $4.35 billion sitting out in front of you, and the word is that most states, if not all states, are applying for that, and Oregon is doing that. The competitive fund grant here with the $4.35 billion of Race to the Top focuses on four primary areas, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in detail, but this the four areas are identified on your sheet there: standards and assessments that prepare students for success, data systems to support instruction, great teachers and leaders, and turning around struggling schools. And those four core reform areas actually go across all the U.S. Department of Education competitive grants and the formula grants, and those are the focus areas that the Recovery Act is encouraging states and school districts and state education associations to be focused around those four areas. And for this grant, the U.S. Department of Ed is looking for ambitious strategies and reforms from the state. This is big stuff they're looking for. And with the goals of driving student gains, substantial gains in student achievement, improving graduation rates and college success, and closing the achievement gap.
Excuse me, Kate.
Mm-hmm.
The Race to the Top is $4.3 billion, and on your pie thing, you said and other grants, the total almost 10.
Right.
Why did you? What do those have in common that made you want to join those piles?
There are the school. Why do you have the pie chart in front of you?
Why are we talking about the other grants?
Those are also grants that that the same themes are applied to, and those are also other grants that Oregon is.
Are they new?
They're part of the Recovery Act piece, and they are new opportunities under the Recovery Act. So, but I'm only talking about the Race to the Top right now.
Okay.
So the theme that goes across those four core reforms that are the strong focus of Race to the Top, there's a synthesis with the other grants and other formula dollars that are coming through the Recovery Act. The application timeline that we're looking for, the proposed requirements were published in the Federal Register this summer, and there were a significant amount of comments on those back to the U.S. Department of Education, and they are more than 1,000, and they are analyzing those now, and we'll be publishing final requirements and the call for the grant, we think, by the end of October, hopefully sooner. And then it's a 60 days after that the application will be due. And, again, that also will be the same with the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund grant, which is a prerequisite. So you have the timeline here in front of you, and just to give you an idea what Oregon's already been doing to prepare for that, as soon as we learned about this and got some focus about where the emphasis would be for this grant, we've put together a Race to the Top design team, which you'll hear a little bit more about, and started meeting even before the proposed guidelines and comments were published. But once those were out, we were able to then hone in a little more on exactly what we would be needing to focus on to make Oregon competitive for this grant. And we've held a number of meetings and developed some working groups that are meeting right now. And in early October, we're hoping we're going to see those final regulations, but we're continuing to work in anticipation of what those are going to be. And the working groups will be turning in October, November, back to the design team to work on completing the application. And in December, we think by the end of December, the Phase 1 applications will be due to the U.S. Department of Ed. One thing that the U.S. Department of Ed did do is offer states two opportunities, two bites of the apple for the Race to the Top grant. There will be a phase one, and that we hope will close here by the end of December, and grants will be made in the spring. But there is also a phase two that will be in the late spring of 2010, and with grants awarded before in next summer. The idea there is to allow states, some states who did have some barriers, to have time to take care of those and before they put in their application. Also, for applicants to the phase one, if they aren't awarded in phase one, it doesn't hurt their ability to reapply in phase two, and they will have some comments back also from the U.S. Department of Ed that might be beneficial for states that weren't awarded in the first round. And I'll pass it off to Margie.
Yeah, Kate, when I'm looking at the four reform areas, it's a slide here, it says, recruiting, develop, retaining, and rewarding effective teachers and principals. Is that going to require some sort of performance-based standard from the guidelines that we're hearing from the feds? Because it kind of appears that way to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, yes, I'll put the short answer to that. It's not overly prescriptive how that happens, and that is one of the areas that Oregon is working on to find what works best here.
Okay, Mr. Chair, that's a real hornet's nest to dive into, so that's something we may want to be thinking about.
It doesn't have to be.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that's one of the particular areas where we have an assigned work group that's studying that particular issue. The federal request for proposals that we anticipate receiving gives a fair amount of latitude to states to define how they will do that. The feds are looking more at the outcome, not the specific process. And so that gives Oregon, along with the other states, some opportunity to study what are the most effective means in which to put that together in a way that fits our particular environment for education and also best benefits Oregon students. That's our focus. Mm-hmm. And that's really the focus across the entire design process. One of the things that the requirement for the proposal has in it is that this grant proposal has to be signed off by both the state superintendent and the chair of the State Board of Education, but also by the governor. So that's why you see kind of this cross-governmental involvement in the proposal. As was noticed by the chair, there are a number of different grants besides the Race to the Top proposal. It's very important to our planning process that Oregon coordinate all of our proposals across each one of those specific subject areas to make sure that they're integrated and cohesive so that we don't have one group moving one direction and a different group not in parallel in what they're proposing. So there's a lot of crossover, both in terms of the overall design team, but also in the subcommittees that have been appointed, so that people who are working on more specific grants besides the Race to the Top are involved in both efforts to increase that collaboration. That's one of the advantages that Oregon really has, is that by being a relatively small state, we're a very collaborative state. The folks who are at the table are there on multiple subjects. And the other part that's really great is that we're making sure that the efforts across each one of those four subject areas are being coordinated between them. Because what happens with struggling schools is very much related to what we're doing with student test scores and teacher performance. You know, those things need to work in tandem, not at cross purposes with each other.
If I may add, Mr. Chair, on top of that, with this, the second application for the State Fiscal Stabilization Fund, that will be what the states have done with that and what school districts have done with that is in that application. They're asking those questions, asking the ability for states to provide data, what their conditions are for that as well. So that also ties to the Race to the Top grant.
Okay.
So as you can tell from the slide five, this is the design team itself. And as you can see, it includes school officials, teachers, union representatives, higher education and community college representatives, people from a wide cross segment of the education establishment in Oregon, and people who really understand where the most critical functions are. Oh, we have the screen up now. and that it's important that all of these folks lend their best expertise as well as their thoughts about how to tie all of the endeavors together. We really see this process as one that the federal government has given us an opportunity to really focus on how to create the best education environment. But we see this as an effort that will pay dividends to Oregon way beyond just the actual grant itself. It's bringing together very important education forces to work collectively for what's best for Oregon students. And yes, it would be really great if we are able to garner some of these additional federal funds as a result of it. But we're going to have improvement in Oregon just because of the strong collaboration and this very sharp focus on how to deliver the best education possible. So to talk on just the four subject areas, the first one is the adoption of internationally benchmarked standards and assessments that prepare students for success in college and in the workplace beyond high school. And the federal government has encouraged the states to adopt common standards across all 50 states. There was an effort that was convened between the chief state school officers and the National Governors Association to design such a set of standards starting late spring. Those have just been released in the last 2 weeks, and fortunately for Oregon, those standards very closely align to the standards that have already been adopted by the Oregon State Board of Education. So we don't have a lot of distance between that common standard that's the movement nationally and what we've already done locally. Now, our challenge is to help school districts be able to adopt and help students succeed in achieving all of those standards. And that's the place where we will probably dedicate part of our emphasis with the grant funds if we are successful in winning them. The second area is in recruiting, developing, retaining, and rewarding effective teachers and principals. This is the area that generally captures that tie of student test score information and how it relates to the evaluation of the personnel who work in our school buildings across the state. As I've said earlier, there's a fair amount of latitude in how districts and the states each approach this. There's agreement that from most of the national research that it's not a single test that ties to a single teacher, because most students are not affected by only one teacher. And as all of us have known from our own personal experiences, sometimes a single test is not the best evaluation of our particular performance. So we're looking at the research and how it suggests evaluating teams of teachers, buildings of teachers, and their school leadership as well, as it relates to a series of tests and other evaluations of student performance. So we're looking, again, for the best fit for Oregon.
Can I ask a question? Senator Bonavici. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk a little bit about how that effective is defined? If it's relying on the scores of the students, is it student, how much a particular student or group of students improves, or is it based on the student test scores compared with the rest of the district or the rest of the state? Because obviously what we all want to avoid is if we're rewarding effective teachers and that's tied to test scores, we want to avoid an incentive for teachers to go teach in, you know, school districts with a high socioeconomic status and make sure that there's still incentives for teachers to go into, for example, low-income schools. So can you talk a little bit about how those test scores will be used to define effective?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, you bring out several very important points that we need to keep in mind as we look at how we'd approach it. I think most of the committee is aware that in Oregon, we've been moving to what we call a growth model, where we look at where was a student at the start of their academic experience in that particular year and what's the progress they make over the time in which they're spending in that particular classroom, so that it's not always a snapshot of just what students across a district do or what every student in that classroom has done, but rather where did that particular student start and have we helped them grow in what they know and can apply at the conclusion of their experience there. It's important that we look at this in terms of equity across socioeconomic status, other demographics. Equity is a very important part of how we're approaching this. We've got several representatives on the design team who have really probed these issues and lived these issues in their local districts, who are helping make sure that we understand how to apply that in a fair and even-handed way to raise all students' performance. The third bullet is an area where Oregon, we feel, really excels. Because of investments that have been made over the last several legislative sessions, Oregon has strong fundamentals in place in terms of the data systems that measure student performance from our pre-kindergarten programs through post-secondary education. And we now have single student identifier that helps us be able to evaluate that. So this is an area that we've got a strong team around. And in addition to this, there are other federal funds available for just this specific proposal that we are developing a parallel grant proposal for that will probably be turned in sometime in late November.
Mr. Chair,
Senators.
At the end of all these federal stimulus programs, one of them was IT for hardwiring schools. How deficient are we going to be at the end of that for having all schools connected in a broadband way?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, that's an area that I don't have the specific details about, but I'd be glad to get that information and get it back to you.
All right, Ms. Chair, that's kind of critical to the whole data network system is having them hardwired in. So, and I know there was stimulus dollars that went to schools and hospitals for that purpose. So,
I can speak to that. Excuse me, I saw all wrong there. Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, the Department of Ed has done a fair amount of analysis about what's needed, and there are a couple of opportunities that have not yet been fully announced for broadband.
Okay.
But they have been preparing for that. There was an early early opportunity, and there will be a later one.
Okay.
So they are looking at that.
The last area is that of the 5% low performing schools in Oregon, well, as well as all the other states. This is an area that's probably one of our largest challenges. None of these schools are low-performing schools because that's where they want to be. And so the challenge is to help apply the principles that have been learned in schools of similar demographic characteristics to help transplant those same ideas and concepts into other school buildings in the state where they have had similar challenges and not had as much success thus far. So this is an area where, we've got to do a lot of serious soul searching about the best way in which to lift these schools. One of the starting challenges is the federal guidelines are fairly open-ended around how we define this. And so the first thing that we need to do is to decide in Oregon, what do we mean when we say low-performing schools? So we're looking at a variety of the different report cards and scorecards and federal performance reviews to see, is there a consistent group of students in schools that are struggling that we need to make sure that we address as we put together a proposal in this area? We also know that whatever we learn from this endeavor will be information that we can apply then to schools that are approaching more of the middle range to also transplant those best practices there as well to make sure that we don't have a different set of schools fall into this category.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a definition of turning around? Is there some quantitative, do you have to turn around by a certain amount or increase scores by a certain amount, or is it just sort of stopping a decline, or is that also open-ended?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, that is open-ended. The states do have the ability to define how we're going to find that success. The federal government has, in another grant category for school improvement grants, some specific strategies, some of which are pretty extreme, including closing the schools. We're hoping that we can find solutions that work better in communities, because some of the places where we have struggling schools, there's not a lot of other school choice available. So we need to find ways in which we improve those educational experiences in those communities, wherever they might be, and to develop a wide range of strategies that will work.
Thank you.
The overall reforms that we're proposing, you know, we are just in the starting phase of this. The work groups have begun their work, and they will be working very rapidly until about the middle of October, and at that point, they're going to turn in their recommendations to the design team as a whole. And then it's going to be the design team under Ms. Fleming's leadership that's going to help us knit all of that together. So I'll turn it over to Vicki.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. Nice to see you all again. I am now serving as the superintendent of the Redmond School District, but worked with many of you in the capacity of deputy superintendent for Susan Castillo before going to Redmond. And so now I have made the intentional switch to go out into the real world and see if all of these things that we talk about at a policy level are possible. And I can tell you they are, but it's very hard work. Susan asked if I would come back and help gather together what Margie mentioned, and that is the A-team of people around Oregon who are thinking and actually making change happen on a daily basis. The design team leadership is broken down as we just described, those four work groups. So we have people in different roles leading those work groups. Matt Coleman is the director of secondary education in Springfield School District. Many of you know Jill Kirk, who's now working on the small schools initiative for E3. They're co-leading the standards and assessment conversation. Dan Jameson is the superintendent in Sherwood School District. He's also been a premier leader in implementing the class initiative of the chalkboard project, so has great expertise in what it's like for a district to actually sit down with union leadership and collaboratively plan for what really looks like mastery teaching and learning and what the compensation system should look like behind that. Mickey Garrison is now working for the Constellation of Education Service Districts, or that enterprise committee. She was formerly an elementary principal in Roseburg and has really developed a statewide implementation of what it means to use data in a data-driven culture and climate, and has a great group of people working with her. And then Mark Mulvihill is an ESD superintendent over in Umatilla, Morrow Counties, and he is working on a variety of things there, very expert in technology deployment, and also has been working with the governor's wraparound project, so has some great perspective on what it means to do work outside of the school system in terms of community schools efforts, human services connections. And then we have one additional area of work that's happening that's not part of the four core work groups, but is being led by Dennis Dempsey. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. This is an invitational priority in the race to the top requests. We get extra points if we propose a set of innovations in that area that are cutting edge, and so that group of folks is beginning their work to propose what we might do to improve science, technology, engineering, and math instruction in our state. So we've been asked in the proposal we have to talk about some critical success factors, and these four questions really we'll have to answer to in terms of our readiness and our ability to take Race to the Top money and put that to good use. Have we created good conditions favorable to education reform through policy, through the way that we've spent our stimulus dollars? Have we made education funding a priority? Is there statewide support and commitment to reform, and can we truly build the capacity to raise achievement, close achievement gaps, and increase graduation rates? I think, in our, as Margie said, in our initial conversations, the group of people that we gathered in a design team over the summer are committed, whether or not we get any of this money. This is a really important moment in Oregon educational history to have this conversation, to bring together the best minds, to really look at what we can do to set the course for the next 10 years in education reform, no matter what. We have several strengths in Oregon. I think the preeminent strength at a policy level and now at an emerging implementation level in the field is our commitment to proficiency-based practice, meaning you have a chart in front of you somewhere that talks about what traditional practices look like in terms of standards and accomplishments and what a proficiency-based system would look like. And I won't go into a great deal of detail about that unless you would like to, but we have... The State Board of Education and the Department of Education have been working on ways to give students credit for being proficient in their ability to demonstrate that they have the knowledge and skills that we require. And the wonderful thing, I think, about proficiency-based practice that I would like you to go away with this morning is that it is a major paradigm shift, and it is emerging from the field. It is not emerging because it was a mandate from the state level, but rather because... pioneering educators who really know what works in terms of teaching and learning for kids are making it happen. We already talked about our strong academic standards. I think you may hear from Duncan Weiss later this morning that our math standards are very closely aligned to the national standards. We may be able to be a state that is an early adopter of those higher aligned standards. We have the longitudinal data systems in place that are beginning to work and are beginning to work in ways that teachers can actually use them in the classroom. We have a growing network of public charter schools. In Redmond, we just opened a brand new charter school this fall called the Redmond Proficiency Academy, and it is completely and totally based on that idea of personalized learning, time being the variable and learning being the constant. It's very exciting work. We have sustained an early childhood investment in Oregon. We have experience with the class project in terms of what really rewards effective teaching in the classroom. We in Central Oregon applied as a consortium of school districts to be a participant in that, and we'll learn a lot about what it means to have a consortium or a collaborative effort. We have other agencies who have launched initiatives, including community schools, and I think you read the school school reform and effectiveness research. We have to go outside the school district, school buildings, into the community to really make sure that we're taking care of students and families and making learning a priority. I think the other effort that's happening that really attaches to this that's really important is the work that you've done, Senator Haas, on looking at education service districts. There's a work group, I believe, that is part of the governor's reset conversation that will be talking about how do we redesign the way we deploy and use our regional delivery systems to build capacity in our schools and toward the outcomes that we would wish to accomplish. I will stop there. I would like to note that this set of slides is in orange and black because it was my way of tying to a thank you to you for funding the OSU Cascades campus in Central Oregon. We're having some very robust conversations among the leaders in that area about how to make that a strong campus tied to the community college programs and to make sure that we are really increasing the rate of college readiness and the rate of students prepared to go on to college in Central Oregon, but that's a very big challenge. The further you get away from the I-5 corridor, I can tell you that it's very ambitious work. So thank you for that.
Ms. Fleming, thank you for chairing this this team and for coming over here today. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I'd like to just push back a little bit and challenge some of your comments to see how you would respond. Your last slide is, Oregon's strengths. So I'd like to have you respond to some maybe Oregon's weaknesses, which isn't the slide there. And I recall, I think it was an Oregonian editorial not long ago, that we may be leading in the race to the bottom, not the race to the top. Part of the race to the top, there's a number of key areas, and you've touched on some of them, and how Oregon is positioned and how you would respond in preparing the applications for this. Length of instructional time is important. And yet in Oregon, we consider compensation for a school year some of the fewest hours, the lower quadrant in the country for instructional time. Alternative ed options is part of this to provide that in charter schools, in virtual schools, and with advanced placement. With we fund like 1.5 person for the entire state for talented and gifted students. We have legislation basically trying to put a tourniquet and kill things like virtual schools and showing everything but what this proposal would be. Compensation, as Senator Cruz pointed out, we like to consider the best teachers and the worst teachers the same in terms of how they're compensated, and that there's we resist that very heavily here, which is also one of the requirements of this. We talk about standards, and yet, you know, and from the Board of Education that, you know, times are tough. Our first response is not to charge the hill, but to raise the white flag and retreat from all of our new standards. We've been doing that for a decade and a half, starting with our SIM and CAM, and now with our new standards. It's, you know, retreat is our message. You mentioned the ESDs. You know, try and talk about innovation and the strong resistance, and this time again successful in preserving the institutional manner. And then even on the design team of the 22 people there, it looks like 19 of them are part of the educational establishment. So if I look at that, and I'm looking at all the other states doing other things, and as the Oregonian had indicated, tell me why we would be successful in racing to the top when it looks like in a lot of this primary criteria, we work at preserving what we're doing now and resisting a lot of those aims.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, you point out a list of the challenges that the committee is very aware of. And I think that it's been a very daunting challenge, but that people are really recognizing that flexibility is going to be required on all fronts in order to make progress and to be competitive in our proposal. So, I think all of us who are around that table have found that there's been a great deal of willingness for folks to yield on ground that in the past they might have said they weren't going to back away from. And, you know, this national agenda is helping change our local agenda. And it's not happening in a flash, but in times of policy change, it's moving very rapidly, much faster than what I've observed movement having occurred in education or many of our other policy areas in the state in the past. And some of it is recognition that we don't want to be left behind and we don't want our students to be left behind. So I think that all of us are very encouraged by the spirit of cooperation that we're seeing from all parties engaged in the conversation. And that's where it's important that we keep everybody at the table and keep an open mind around the approaches that are going to work. There were definitely some places where people initially when they saw it, the proposals and the standards that were coming out of the Secretary of Education, we were like, you know, that's not going to happen here. But we are seeing a lot of parties reconsidering those initial reactions and doing that in a pretty fast pace in a policy environment. So we are very aware of the list of challenges that you enumerated.
Well, if I can, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I wish you the very best in doing that. But I think part of the pathway to being success is to recognize the weaknesses because they're going to be be aired, certainly, and a plan to address those because, you know, recognizing that whole playing field is going to be critical, and we can talk about our strength, which is important, but not to recognize the 800-pound gorillas that are in the room, you know, could be an impediment to actually being successful. So, you know, best of luck with that.
Senator Hast, Senator Mesker, I'd like to speak to that from a local superintendent perspective and how difficult it is to initiate change. I agree with your list. We do. We have challenges in all of those areas. I am the largest school district in Oregon that went to a four-day school week because of our budget constraints this year, which didn't please me at all and has been a very difficult transition for us. We did that because we had trade-offs to make, and the trade-offs were increasing our class sizes, eliminating between 200 and 250 electives at our high school, and laying off more people, frankly. At the end of our budget process, we had about two dozen classified and licensed employees that we actually had to reduce our force. So I feel exactly the visceral pain of the list that you just rattled off, and I'm not going to complain about money because I know what's happening in the nation and in Oregon. We're doing the best with what we have available to us. The opportunities that that has created in our district in terms of the four-day school week, we have a mayor who led an initiative of a bunch of our community partners, including Boys and Girls Club, 4-H, Parks and Recreation. We now have a Friday, Choice Friday, it's called. We have more than 50 different activities that students can choose from on that day that are really sponsored and managed by the community. So in the crisis became an opportunity to extend learning time and to get the community involved in ways that they have not been involved in the past. This past year, I, along with our school board, closed an alternative high school that was persistently underperforming. And I can tell you that that caused a shock that was heard around the world and was very difficult in terms of the leadership responsibility that comes with that. There are those of us in Oregon who are very anxious and impatient and, in fact, see a great sense of urgency about the things that this set of reforms proposes and are not willing to sit back and wait for them to happen but are actually making them happen in the field. The difficulty is taking those kinds of difficult reforms to scale and making sure that we're doing what we know is right and what we know is possible throughout the system. And I think there is a huge leadership challenge in this, both locally and at the state level, and we need your help with that. We need you to be strong and to really listen and hear what these design team and the working groups come up with in terms of policy and actions that we need to take to align ourselves with the change that is absolutely essential for kids who need us to be there for them. So keep asking those hard questions. We look forward to that.
And if I could add, one of the things that's in the federal requirements for this proposal is that the state has to sign off on our adherence to each of those different federal requirements, but before any local school district can receive the funds, and over half of the funds have to go to local school districts, that local school district also has to sign off on the same set of criteria. And, you know, perhaps it's one benefit of the financial challenges that every governmental entity is facing right now is that, you know, in order for the districts to access these additional resources, they also are going to have to embrace the same reforms. That's the reason why it's so important that they all be involved in the conversation as we're building the proposal. We want to put together a plan that they are going to be able to embrace.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzer, just to play on that a little bit more, too, you didn't see the list of all the working group, the variety of organizations and representation on those four working groups. It's very broad. These are not working groups solely of the design committee. It's very broad. There is also, right now, we're in the process of identifying and naming an advisory group. That's very broad as well, to run initial drafts past and gain feedback. And one of the requirements, or at least has been in the proposed requirements for the Race to the Top, is that not only do you have the sign-off of those districts, you also are looking to your union and letters of support from key stakeholders. So this is really an opportunity, and I think this grant is intended to be an opportunity to bring all these forces together, and the U.S. Department of Ed has been very clear that they are encouraging us to offer something different, something innovative, something that will work in our state. And so they've been very open to what we're able to present to them rather than being too prescriptive.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Metzger, for asking and commenting about something that's troubled me as well. The question that I have is, if you look at the dollars that are available, and assuming that Oregon is in the average range, we would be receiving about $43 million as a percent of the total population, if we kind of fall into the
1%
of those funds. And my question is, you know, when you have grant funds, surely all of those funds are not going to be spent on planning and idea creation and all that. Some of those will go into implementation. How do we then bridge the gap between the deficiency that we already have in funding, and now we've created something new with the expectation that it's going to continue? How do we make sure that there's a life to these innovations and reforms that, in fact, will carry forward into the future?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, the funds are, these are competitive grants, so not all 50 states are going to be awarded these grants. They expect that there will be maybe 10 to 12 states who receive these funds. So, you know, if we're in that fortunate dozen of states, our share will be more than the $43 million that would be our usual pro rata share. But along with that, the states have a four-year period in which to expend the funds. So certainly a part of any effective delivery is solid planning, but there's also going to be, as you've pointed out, implementation. So there will be a phase-in process to this, and school districts will need to identify ways in which to do that so that once the funding is gone, because it is just a four-year grant, that then they can sustain it with local resources.
If I could build on that, Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, the U.S. Department of Ed has also not identified any floor or ceiling for this. So our approach has been to plan or will be, and we're in the process, early process of putting together our plan and then fitting the budget to it. The Department of Ed would rather see something that's realistic, attainable, sustainable, and fund that accordingly rather than adjusting the plan for the dollars. But that has to, you're exactly right, that has to be part of the planning. And the expectation, too, is that the participating districts will act as a model as well, that this is an opportunity to put in place a model that then can be translated to other districts going forward.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I just want to add from a local perspective, we are spending our stimulus dollars, and we know they will be probably one time, two years worth of money that is funding a set of activities that will build capacity for us to do business differently, meaning that we will have a different skill set at the end of that investment because of the way we're using data and the way we're approaching that growth, if you will, in our schools and in our classrooms. And we're hoping that that stands and has some sustainability after that, even though we know that those positions, which we're now funding our instructional coaches and one in every building, we will not be able to afford that after this year in all likelihood. But we will have a different way of doing things because we've made that investment up front. And I think we have to approach this money in that particular way, the capacity building, the paradigm shift that we need to make around proficiency and its time and its investment in professional development and the way we do business. I think there are a lot of things that we know what to do and we know how to do them, and it is the full execution of them in the system that sometimes doesn't cost a lot of additional money that we have to require ourselves to be serious about.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. First, you mentioned something about the STEM priority. And as someone who wants to make sure that the arts and humanities aren't left behind, is there cause for concern because of the emphasis on science and technology and math for someone who believes that there also needs to be emphasis on arts and humanities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, the way in which the federal scoring process works, the STEM aspect is the only place where states can earn extra credit, I guess, if you use education analogy, in the overall scoring criteria. So that's the reason why we have a STEM component. But certainly, at the heart of what we're doing around embracing the national standards is it's not just the mathematics. It's also language arts and all of the other aspects of building a solid curriculum for effective learning that's there. I think all of us know that without solid language arts skills, it's very difficult for students to learn in just about any other subject area. So that's just the foundation piece. It's got to be there.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, we also had that conversation in our design team early on, and there were several of us who felt exactly like you do, that we would like a portion of this dedicated to the arts and humanities area. And I think the general consensus of the group was we have some real core work to do before we can afford to, and fortunately that's usually the conversation that happens with the arts. I would love to talk with you further about ways that we can promote that initiative in a different way, perhaps with some of the competitive priorities. I know the Oregon Arts Commission is very actively thinking about that. And I also, before we close, wanted to thank and mention the contribution that Meyer Memorial Trust is making to this effort. They stepped up early on and worked with the Superintendent of Public Instruction to say they would assist with grant writing and process coaching and assistance and have been marvelous all the way along. So it's not just the us public servants that are.
I noted that, too. Doug Stamm has been interested in this. I've talked to him a number of times about this. There are two people from his organization that are on here. So.
And I did have a brief follow-up.
Yes, Senator Bonamici.
If I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. The second part of my question, although it's not necessarily related, is there was some discussion about the, Ms. Fleming, you mentioned charter schools, and Senator Metzger mentioned alternative education options. Is there a place to recognize the sort of creativity and innovation within the existing public school system, and, for example, magnet schools or the nationally recognized Japanese immersion program in Portland, for example, when you have those types of programs within the existing public schools now, is there a place to recognize that sort of creativity and innovation, or is it only new and different options that are recognized as important for this process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, are you talking about recognizing in terms of rewarding with compensation or recognizing in terms of best practice or
well, the discussion was, it seemed to be that we need to have, and I've heard this in the Race to the Top discussion, that you need to have no barriers, for example, to alternative options, and that is part of the consideration. So I just want to know that whether the existence of those sort of options within the existing public school system is going to help us, going to hurt us, be neutral in terms of the process?
I hope so. I know that it's very controversial here in Oregon and in many states, the whole charter school movement, but I can tell you the greatest innovations that I've seen happen in my tenure have been when you get sort of out of the box and can sort of separate your governance model and work with ideas freely. And I know the virtual education, when I was at the department, was very much a part of creating that virtual school district. I see virtual learning options as obviously being the wave of the future. We need to have access to those kinds of options for every single student in Oregon, and how we build the systems to do that. I think who pays for it and who makes money from it is the natty issue that task force will have to figure out and recommend to us. But absolutely pushing out and knowing what's happening outside of the mainstream system in order to be able to bring it back into the mainstream system. proficiency is a great example of that. We had our proficiency movement in Redmond started in the freshman academy in the mainstream high school and flourished to the extent that it became a learning model now in a charter environment. So we have both, and we're working on both. And I think we have to continue to do that as well. Thank you.
Senator Cruz? First of all, I agree with everything Senator Metzger said.
Everything?
Well, in that one statement, there's things he said before that I question, but we're just here today, and I do have, quite honestly, some great concerns with states that blindly chase federal dollars with short duration. I think we're going to fall off some cliffs in some other stimulus dollars that we have collected in Medicaid and a few places like that. So I think we need to be very mindful of the short duration of these things. But having said that, when I look at the leaders of the design teams, work groups, I am very impressed. That is a very good group. I expect good things from them. I just thought I'd end it on a positive, but I know these people, and they're good.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Thank you for this update. This is one of the most important things we have in education right now at this point for this state. And so,
thank you for your time.
You. Okay, we're going to move to a quick update on extended learning and year-round education, the status and implementation of Senate Bill 484. Morgan Allen and Dana Hepper are here to update us on that.
Thank you.
Welcome to both of you. Morgan, if you want to begin and just summarize where things stand and
well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and I have a pretty brief update on specifically implementation of Senate Bill 484 from the 09 session. If you remember, Senate Bill 484 allowed the department to establish a pilot program to encourage school districts to provide supplemental instruction programs to help focus in on improving student achievement. You might remember this was Senator Hass's bill, and apparently was his attempt to become the most unpopular man amongst Oregon school children in Oregon. But I guess all kidding aside, I think it's generally acknowledged by all education experts that increasing instructional time and when you have a high-quality teacher or classified staff and administrators teaching those students, that's going to have the greatest impact on student achievement. And I think, you know, in passing this bill and recognizing this, Oregon's a little bit ahead of the curve nationally. For example, in the last week or so, you may have seen there have been several articles. The U.S. Department of Education is beginning to tackle this subject and is looking at ways to encourage states and school districts to find additional classroom time, whether it's in the summer or during the school year. But it's become a big hot topic at the national level on education. And again, for students who are struggling to achieve academically, and particularly, you know, for students who start out in school behind their peers, it's one of the most proven methods to help bring them up to speed and help them catch up with their classmates. So specifically on Senate Bill 484, what we have done, you know, we're still pretty early in the biennium getting our stuff together, but we have got a few things in the works for Senate Bill 84. I've brought a copy of a letter that actually Dana, the senator, and myself have worked on that we are going to send out from Superintendent Castillo and Senator Hass to a list of businesses and community foundations in Oregon that have some track record of supporting educational programs. So I'm working on finalizing that list right now and hope to get that letter out in a few weeks. But you should have a copy of the final letter we're going to send out coming around to you. I've also asked our staff to do research on any of the, whether there's any federal funds aside from, say, the stimulus dollars that might be coming in, whether there are other federal grant opportunities available that we might be able to apply for and bring to Oregon. Unfortunately, our staff have not been able to find any specific to this yet, but we are hopeful with the new emphasis at the federal level that Secretary Duncan and the U.S. Department may find some small pots of money we could apply for that we could zero in and help with Senate Bill 40 for implementation. The other thing that I've asked our staff to do, and probably see something go out in October or November, we're going to try to do some research into districts that have these types of programs. I think there is not, we have anecdotal stories and information about school districts and schools that are providing, you know, extra instructional time or summer instructional programs for their students, but I think it would be important as part of the pilot to try to gather some of that information and find out what's going on and see if there are any programs that we can replicate or duplicate. And oftentimes we find out about funding opportunities that school districts may have been able to tap into that we're not aware of, that, you know, from the state and federal level. So I think, you know, that's the good news. I think the hard reality, again, is in tough budget times, and I think this was talked about a little bit in the race to the top discussion. Unfortunately, these are the types of programs that when school districts are, you know, making budget cuts, you know, they have to, you know, make some tough decisions. And these are some of the programs, including, you know, music, art, PE. Those are the types of things that end up on chopping block. So this bill is timely, and hopefully we can get some private donations, some foundation support. And I think there's a glimmer of hope that there might be some federal funds available to do this. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we'll go to Dana.
Right. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the statewide advocacy director with Stand for Children. And first, I just want to say I'm really excited that this committee and the Oregon legislature is talking about the issue of expanding learning time for students and taking showing some leadership on something that's so important for kids. Last spring, we were all, you all more than me, but we were all working hard to figure out exactly what was going to be in that 2009-11 budget. Stanford Children members formed a task force to explore what schools and districts across Oregon were doing that was impressive and notable in incredibly tough budget times. And the task force found pretty clearly that there is no silver bullet in education reform. What really works in improving public schools is when teachers and principals come together to decide what they need for their students and to implement it with faith and collaboration. And so we went out and talked to, we set out a goal of talking to 1,000 people this summer and have so far talked to 1,200, including 700 teachers. And the issue of time comes up just as much as the issue of money. And you can see why, including my testimony, I've also included a few slides from a PowerPoint from the National Center on Time and Learning. Does everyone have that? So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why time is just becoming an increasing concern. And the first slide there is time is a huge factor, as Morgan mentioned, in closing the achievement gap. If we can give kids that are behind more time, we can significantly close the achievement gap. And Massachusetts is a statewide pilot program to do just that, and that's what they're finding. They're improving student achievement across the board, but they're really notably cutting the achievement gap in half. We've seen a narrowing of the curriculum with No Child Left Behind, and there's a slide on that in there. We're spending more time on reading and math, but significantly less time on recess and electives, which kids need as well, we know. Obviously, we're spending a lot less time in Oregon and the United States on learning, period, than other states are spending. And teachers state the time they need more time to collaborate with and learn from each other. Which is another thing that's been cut out of the school day and is increasingly important in the 21st century. So just wanted to flag that. I've also included a few pages of the report from the Quality Education Commission about what really notable schools in Oregon are doing. And I've just included the section here on time, which just shares what some schools are doing to expand learning time. But I'll quickly share a couple of examples about what some schools are doing. So Journal Elementary School is an example of a school that's using the existing funding that the state receives, but they've added 25 minutes a day to their school day, which definitely adds up over the course of the year. And they've just done it through creative scheduling. The district has allowed them to have the first and last bus of the day. The principal takes the students every morning for 20 minutes to do PE collectively as a group. They do calisthenics and yoga and stretching and that kind of thing, which allows the teachers time to collaborate with each other while the students are in a learning environment and getting the physical activity that they need to start the day. I think I need 20 minutes of calisthenics every morning. And then they've also done some great things to group the students differently over the course of the day. So the kids, although they have a 1 to 26 student to teacher ratio, they spend a lot of the day in groups of 13 with their teacher while the other 13 students are learning with, say, a member of the Oregon Symphony who's teaching them violin. So they've just done some really creative things around scheduling at a regular public school that have allowed them to extend the school day. And then in drawing off of community resources to extend learning time, I think Multnomah County Sun Schools are just a phenomenal example of that that have been around for quite a long time. And they're showing that students who come to after-school programs at Sun Schools in Multnomah County and students who have parents and families participating in the programs that Sun Schools provide for families are doing better in school. They're doing a lot better in terms of, do you have an adult you can trust and talk to? Are you coming to school on time and ready to be successful? But they're also doing better on things, measures like standardized tests. And then finally, I also wanted to flag for you Massachusetts, which has embarked on a statewide initiative to expand learning time for struggling schools in Massachusetts. They've invested up to $1,300 a student in state resources at 26 schools in Massachusetts to improve outcomes in the core academic areas, but also to broaden enrichment opportunities for students and to add more planning and professional development time for teachers. And they're seeing significant improvements, as I mentioned, in student learning. And even more impressively, they've cut the achievement gap in half in those schools. That's just a little overview of what happened, and this is what's happening, and this is a huge topic for the state to tackle. But I think I just want to reinforce that we're so glad that you are discussing it, talking about it, taking leadership on it, and starting to tackle it in Oregon. And Stanford Children is certainly committed to doing anything we can do to help you tackle this incredibly challenging topic. But we know that more times makes a difference for kids. Thanks.
Thanks to both of you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan and Dana, I want to just make sure that you are aware of and perhaps working with a supporting student success project in Oregon. Oregon is one of five states that did receive some federal grant money to study early learning opportunities, and I'm honored to be part of the team. We just had our first meeting recently. And I'll just let the committee and you know about the sort of description of the task that we're undertaking. The Oregon S3 team will conduct a complete review of existing after-school programs, federal and state funding streams, and the current Oregon statutes that have relevance to after-school expanded learning opportunities. Resulting report will include recommendations for system integration and policy change, provide a clear picture of Oregon's after-school funding history and the current barriers that exist in terms of access to programs, et cetera. The team also intends to establish data collection processes on expanded learning opportunities in the state of Oregon. Currently, there's no central data repository for expanded learning opportunities, nor is there any coordination among agencies and organizations. So this is a task that the team is looking at to examine all the identified funding streams that support after-school programs to determine what and how data is collected by each funding stream and then analyze that data to begin having a baseline of where the programs are located, what funds they receive, document the range of funding sources, both public and private. And then long-term develop legislation that creates a common understanding of after-school programs and make necessary changes to state policies in order to promote increased coordination and provide funding.
and increased access to expanded learning opportunities. So that's work that just got started with the assistance of a federal grant that's really looking at the data and trying to gather as much information as possible. So I certainly invite the collaboration between your efforts and the efforts of the team. Ed Dennis is part of the team. So just to make sure, and Representative Riley is the other legislative member, just to make sure that we aren't duplicating efforts and sharing all of our information. So thank you very much for your presentation.
And Senator Bonamici, we've been talking to Furman Brown, the president of Generation Schools, and he's going to testify to this committee in November.
Great.
So, but it's pretty interesting what he's finding, that by a creative mix of juggling schedules, teachers' schedules, you can add days with minimal cost or at least less. And I think that's kind of what we're trying to figure out how to do. Is, so anyway, thank you for the update. And we'll go from year-round education to high school graduation requirements. Duncan Wise is here from the State Board. Welcome, Mr. Wise.
Good morning, members, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Duncan Wise. I'm the chair of the State Board of Education, and thank you for inviting me to discuss and update you on the Oregon Diploma Project. I have very good news. The Oregon Diploma is alive and well. I want to remind you today of the context for the new diploma, the general requirements that we've established, talk with you about the adjustments we have made in the timelines in our August board meeting. And also, I think, really importantly, talk with you about the connections we are making with the new diploma requirements in higher education and employers. I think it's all quite an important part of where we're going. We've been before you, of course, before, and I know you're familiar with it, but I thought it would be good just to step back and remind the committee of why we're doing this, what the diploma is all about, and really what the major elements are. I think this, I'm going to be describing does connect very well with what you heard on the Race for the Top application. I do think there are features in this diploma that give Oregon an edge going forward. I was recently back in Washington, D.C., learned what other states are doing, and again, I don't think we necessarily understand that we are doing some things here that are different, that I think are special and are going to give our students advantage as they go into their lives by the design of our diploma. So what are we trying to do? First, broadly, what's the objective? We set a goal for our state to change the education system, pre-K through higher education, with the aim that all students will be able to gain the skills necessary to go on to college, go on to a career that requires high skills, to have a meaningful life that beyond high school gives them that provides good quality jobs, prepares people for citizenship, and enables them to navigate in an increasingly complicated world. That's a very different vision from what our expectations traditionally have been in terms of what the high school diploma requires. It's a different vision, and that's really what is embedded in these diplomas. We have looked at the national research, we've engaged with citizens in Oregon, and we have raised the bar on the high school diploma. What are the features? They come in really four broad categories. The first is the more traditional ones, the credit requirements. And you're familiar with that. You added some through the legislature. We added some more beyond the legislature. We've increased the requirements in math, including the requirement starting next year, the freshman must begin at the Algebra 1 level to get credit in high school. We've increased the science from 2 to 3 classes. We've stepped up the second language arts and career ed requirements from 1 to 3. So we've ratcheted up the credit requirements, and that's one piece of the change in the diploma. Perhaps more exciting in some ways, and many other states have fallen along these lines, but we've also added other features which I think are very important. The second feature, which again is perhaps not as well understood, but Vicki and Margie discussed it earlier, is the notion of credit for proficiency. For some time, the board has created a framework to allow students and districts who want to allow credit based on proficiency in a particular class to gain credit through a variety of different pathways, whether it's applied learning, a different classroom practice, online learning, a different model for documenting learning. And what we're seeing now, as you heard earlier, is innovation going on in all kinds of ways around the state, which is really pathbreaking. And I'm just going to give you one example. Since Vicki's in the room, I'll use her district. When Vicki is in some ways too humble about what they've done in Redmond High School, their freshman class had a dropout rate of 18%. Under the traditional model of credit requirements in the Redmond High School. The first year they adopted the credit for proficiency model, the dropout rate went from 18% to zero. And what they found is when you explain to a student in advance what the learning requirements are, when you make it very clear that the class is about actually mastering the subject matter, you make it clear how you can demonstrate mastery of the subject area, the students are propelled to learn. As opposed to the traditional classroom model where it's more around attendance, homework, you know, and the traditional 100-point scale, when you actually are very clear about the learning, you propel it in a way that's really magical for the students and gives a lot more flexibility in terms of the learning processes for students to learn at their own pace. This is potentially revolutionary. We've enabled it through the diploma requirements, this model, which again I think stand us very well for learning in the 21st century. Whatever happens on the race for the top, as Margie says, I think this is a big deal. We're starting to see it around the state. We're seeing spikes in science scores and SCAPOOS. We're seeing this above all. The students and the teachers are on fire on this. They really like it. And it's a model that I think you're going to hear a lot more about. It is coming up from the bottom. We at the state level are facilitating, enabling it. But ultimately, this is really innovation that's happening on the ground. Very exciting work. So that's the second piece of the diploma. The third piece is also pretty unusual for Oregon in comparison to other states, is the essential skills. To graduate in Oregon, we are requiring students, again, using proficiency, to demonstrate mastery in essential skills at pretty high levels of skills. And in the areas we focused on first were reading, writing, speaking, and math. And as you know, we had set those goals for 2012 originally. We have changed the schedule, and we did that because of the funding shortfalls, and we said at the time we would monitor this carefully so that we didn't put demands on students that we couldn't provide the services to meet. And so we've adjusted the timeline. I will tell you, this is one of the decisions where you probably, I feel as a board member, we're probably just about right because everybody's mad at us for different reasons. So a lot of the schools are saying, the schools advocated that we extend the timelines a lot more. Others have probably, you will tell me, we're not pushing hard enough. I think it's actually about right. We've engaged very deeply with superintendents. We had a lot of discussions about this. And just to be clear on what we're doing is, the current sophomores must demonstrate mastery in reading to graduate. So they're on the hook for that. And they can demonstrate reading through the Oaks test, by passing the Oaks test, through a number of other multiple choice tests that we've adopted, or through a new locally based assessment that the department is making available to the district. So a variety of assessments, but in all cases quite rigorous. And again, requirement to demonstrate reading. The current freshmen will not only have to demonstrate the essential skills in reading, they will also have to demonstrate writing, either using the state assessment again or a variety of other assessment tools that will be available. But again, at pretty high levels, we want everyone to be able to write. And then next year's freshmen will need to be able to read, write, and apply math at very rigorous standards, meeting the new state benchmarks, which is really a very high standard in math. Depending on how you describe it, who you talk with, but it's certainly geometry, statistics, and algebra, and again, ability to apply it at a pretty high level. We believe with these three essential skills, Oregon students will be prepared for the fundamentals they need to go on to college. And also to meet meaningful career opportunities, to give them the flexibility to navigate a variety of career paths through their lives, move forward. We did delay speaking, and we'll come back to that this year. And the reason we did, frankly, again, is just a capacity issue. The superintendents were concerned. You know, each time you add one more requirement, and again, requiring every student, and this is what I want to stress, we're requiring all students to demonstrate these. If students aren't meeting them, we feel incumbent that we give additional time and resources to help students get up to speed so they have the opportunity to graduate. And so it was that resource question that really, I think, was on the board's mind as we made the decision, but we'll come back to that. The essential skills are a critical part of the diploma, and again, I think are positioning Oregon very well in a, if you will, a proficiency-based world. The final piece, which I don't think we talk enough about, is in the Oregon diploma, is the whole notion of personalized learning. The education plan and profile has been in place for some time. We require students to have the opportunity to extend their learning in real-world settings, to apply their learning. We think it's really important that not only you gain the academic skills, but you have the opportunity to apply those skills in a career or a setting or an area of interest, whether it's the arts or any number of areas. And again, those standards have been in place, and again, I think add real value to the whole context for the high school student in Oregon. So that's where we are in terms of the requirements. Again, I think they're very solid. The great news is I think we've got good buy-in for this model. We've spent a lot of time with the stakeholders, and again, there's debate on the timing of it, but I don't hear anyone debating whether this is the right path. I think we've got a broad consensus that this is a good model to move forward, and we intend to do so. I am also, just finally, really excited about the partnerships. When we adopted this in August, one of the things we decided was whether the particular essential skills is required for graduation, we want to record whether the student has met the essential skill in reading, writing, and math by 2012. So on the transcript, we will have whether you've met the reading, writing, or math on the transcripts. Now, the importance of that is, for higher ed, both the community college system and the university system have committed to look at those essential skills standards for purposes of placement. Our goal is, in the community college system, and Cam Preuss has agreed to work on this, is that if you meet the three essential skills in reading, writing, and math, you will automatically be placed at college level, and you won't have to take the placement exam in the community college system. That's a big deal. Saves money, and it guarantees placement. She's committed to doing that. And George Pernsteiner is similarly committed to acknowledging the three essential skills. So a student right now who can meet all three will know that they have value into the university and community college system. That's our aim, and we're going to be working on that this year. We also have connected the new diploma in the essential skills to employers. Recall the last session you supported the career readiness certificate, the work keys, if you recall, where it's an assessment of work-related skills, again, in reading, in math, in applied math, and applied reading in that context. We adopted those assessments for the essential skills, and we are now, through a joint effort in the business community and the employment community, focusing on encouraging employers to use those tools for employment purposes. And again, that's going to be a broad outreach, which you supported through legislation. And so we not only are making the connections with the higher ed system, but we're starting to make the connections with the essential skills through the work keys into the employer community. So I think there are a lot of connections that are getting made that are going to make the diploma more meaningful and going to accelerate this work, and again, give the signal to students why they need to do this, why it's important, because the Next Step partners care about it. So I know some of you are frustrated that we delayed a bit. I will tell you, others are frustrated that we didn't delay enough. But again, we're committed to the vision, and I think we're on the right path. And again, you're going to see a more rigorous diploma unfold in the years ahead. And I think we as a state can be very proud of where we're going. And I'm particularly incredibly proud of the students and the school community itself for stepping up to do this, because it's really hard work, and it's a demand. Again, I said at the outset, we have never had this high a level of requirement before. It's a new day, and it's a big deal for the future of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. I know how you feel when I used to feel this way in the news business, when everybody's mad at you, you feel like you did your job.
Mm-hmm.
Question on the math content standards. Mm-hmm. There's great concern now because of what's happened in the economy and bad loans about financial literacy.
Yes.
Can you tell us if that's being addressed in these standards?
Yes.
And what concerns you may or may not have if we were to inject that back into the system? We ran into some technical roadblocks in
right.
the last session, but I know this isn't your person.
Yes. No, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I look to Senator Metzger here. And we now have two members of our board, the Secretary of State and the Treasurer, who are going to be helping us both with the civic standards and the personal finance standards. We did, like you, hear the report. It was a very excellent report that the legislature asked for. And we are committed to taking a hard look at the personal finance standards. The issue on personal finance is they weave into the math, they weave into the social sciences, they weave into a number of areas. I think what the board is committed to is not I don't think we're interested in having a class specifically, but we are very interested in thinking through what knowledge and skills do we need to impart in students in the area of personal finance. And it is something we'll be, you know, we've heard that we're going to be working on that. And again, I think math creates a great opportunity. I mean, there are obviously lots of opportunities to apply math in a personal finance setting, whether it's compound interest or any number of other ideas. And we've talked a lot about that. And so, yeah, as we look at the tools for implementation of the math standards, we're very mindful that personal finance is a big opportunity to show how you apply those standards in context and meaning.
Questions, Senator Metzger?
Yeah, well, and thank you for bringing that up, Mr. Chair. Just a note on that. I think, Duncan, you've hit on what I think is the right approach, and we talked about it during session. It's not creating a class. It's creating a curriculum. Mm-hmm. And then deciding, you know, each, whether it's in the science class or the math class or the civics class, and in each of the particular departments, you know, who's responsible for a certain portion of that curriculum. And then the only thing that would be uniform, I think, down the road would be an assessment of the students, but multiple departments and their teachers would be responsible for teaching it. It's not a class. And like you say, the practical parts of it come in different parts. You know, the computations, you know, may be part of the math curriculum, but it is integrating those particular skills into the various academic subject matter that then would lead to an assessment that allow to show that they can grasp those. And I think that is the right approach. And I think it is time that that we move, you know, more aggressively in saying this is an important skill and our people are talented enough to figure out how to integrate a curriculum mm-hmm. with various people to do that and, you know, not necessarily have additional class time. So,
all right.
Thanks. That's just my comment.
Thank you.
And I appreciate yours.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your update.
Thank you. And please, any time.
Of course.
We appreciate your interest. Thanks.
One of my goals here is to adjourn before noon, and I think we're on schedule. Let's take a five-minute break and come back with a shared responsibility model.
That's true.
Are there any recesses?
We're in recess for 5 minutes. Welcome back. We resume our informational hearing. Review of our shared responsibility model allocations, and I think we have those folks here, Dennis and a couple of students.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dennis Johnson, Executive Director of the Student Assistance Commission, and I guess a couple of students from OSA, perhaps?
Yes. Good morning, Chair Haas and committee. My name is Crystal Sandoval, and I'm from Western Oregon University.
Hello, good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christopher Proudfoot, and I'm from Portland State University.
Very good. All of you on the committee see enough data to know what I was doing with that first piece of information on the handout in front of you. And we'll get that projected in just a moment, I hope. But I intentionally copied it in what's called a portrait format, because if I had put that in landscape or horizontal, it would have flattened the curve. And we all need to be impressed by what this represents. I called it an application tsunami, and partly that's because we really don't know if it will result in an enrollment tsunami. Wouldn't it be wonderful if it also became retention and completion data that we were all monitoring a few years from now? But what we know right now is that the basis, the data that we based the action that you took, passing Senate Bill 334, and not only putting in statute but funding the shared responsibility model, all of that was based on data that's kind of represented by the bottom line on this chart. In other words, we were expecting to serve maybe 34,000 or so students a year. Last year, we served over 38,000 students with this program, and this year, we're blowing the top off with the application, the interests so far. We don't know yet how many of those students will ultimately enroll, how many will actually stay, how many are running into capacity issues on campus. In other words, they can't get the courses that they need, or perhaps some of them can't even get the help that they need to put together the rest of their financial aid package. But we do know that the interest is there, and it's pretty overwhelming. We're in completely uncharted territory. We get a quarter of a million or so FAFSAs each year, and that FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, is what we monitor with this chart. We're off the charts in terms of the amount of interest and in terms of the viable candidates for this program, the undergraduate Oregon residents who are planning to attend an Oregon institution and who have some eligibility remaining for the program. So to recap just a bit, what we were able to do with last year's program, the first year of the shared responsibility model, was make some dramatic progress. If you look at just what we did in terms of the income limits on the awards, as you know, socioeconomic profile that's represented by these family incomes, as it were, you can see that for 2008-2009, we were able to get up into the middle class here in Oregon. Family median income of perhaps 60-some thousand, individual or overall median income of over 40,000 in Oregon. Clearly, we made some headway. The program had a cap of a $70,000 adjusted gross income. We were actually able to have some eligible students in that range of $68,000. For the current year, the year just beginning now, 2009-10, that will reverse somewhat. We still have the same $70,000 cap. The actual cohort that we will be serving doesn't get up much below or much above $45,000 in adjusted gross income or in family income. And the difference is because of the way the formula operates. It will perhaps also be because of the vast number of people that we're serving. Moving ahead to the actual average income of recipients, we divided that out between dependent and independent students. We're serving many more independent students than ever before, many, many of them in the community college sector. And you know what all this implies. This is last year's data, but it will look quite a bit different for 2009, 2010. We'll be probably back down again. It's not just a function of the number of students, but also of the type of students, dislocated workers, recently unemployed, that kind of thing. Many, many single independents or many independent students with dependents of their own. So overall, we went up in the average income last year. We were able to distribute more to not just the very neediest, but some of the lower income and middle income families that we hadn't been able to serve in the past. Comparing disbursements and recipients, we overlaid that data on this graph, and you can see how dramatic this is, a near doubling, or actually almost exactly doubling the funds from 2007-2008 to last year, 2008-09. The number of recipients, I mentioned we were planning to serve about 34,000. We ended up serving 38,800, as the graph shows. This year, it's still an open question. The reason that the bar for 2009-10 goes down, as much as anything else, is increased federal funding. If you remember the concept of the shared responsibility model, when one of the shares goes up, the other shares can go down. In this case, the federal Pell Grant that is a portion of the funding for most of the students, not all the students, but for most of them who get the grant, federal Pell Grants have gone up. Now, we also know that tuition and fees have gone up dramatically. And for many community college students, the increase in Pell Grant was offset by an increase in tuition and fees. So I don't mean to indicate that this is progress necessarily. Another component here is the federal tax credit that many of the students who get the Oregon Opportunity Grant will be able to get. The difficulty with the federal tax credit, of course, is they don't get that till they file their taxes for what is the current tax year right now, 2009. They will be able to take a form that they get from the school that tells them what they paid in fall quarter or fall semester, tuition fees, they can add books, that kind of thing in. They will be able to get some of that back. If they're dependent students, it will be a result of their parents filing a tax return. If they're independent students, it will be their own Form 1040 or 1040 EZ. The difficulty with that, of course, is you have to pay tuition, fees, books, supplies, all those, room and board. If you're moving away from home, you have to pay that in the fall. You don't get any of that federal money back till taxes are filed for the 2009 year. It may or may not be enough to make up for what we're counting in the eligibility formula. So it's a very difficult one, but nonetheless, it is a resource. So what we're going to be doing through the fall and into the winter is mounting another education program to make sure that students know how to apply for this tax credit. For students who don't have enough earned income, we are told by the IRS that there will be a mechanism. We don't know what that is yet, so it's hard to mount this education program when we don't know what the tool will be. We think it will be a modified form of a tax return, perhaps a supplemental form. If you don't have enough earned income, you can still get up to $1,000 in a tax credit. I want you to understand we're working on this. It is extremely complex, and it will be a tall order for us to get the word out to all of those students who should have or could have received tax credits for the 2009 tax year. For the second year of the biennium, that's 2010-11, or the bar on the far right of your graph, we expect that the number will go down further because that is the year that this $1,000 refundable portion of the tax credit really kicks in. Federal Pell Grants will again go up for the second year of the biennium. So for those students who get Pell Grants, and it is by no means, when a maximum Pell Grant goes up $200, not every Pell Grant recipient gets that increase. The very neediest students do, but many of the students will see just a small increase in Pell Grant. Overall, it rolls up. It does help, and it means that in the shared responsibility model, the state share can decline again. That's a look at the statistics. I think it's worth recapping just what that dramatic progress was again. As I said, funds almost doubling, up 96% from the previous year. So the first year of the program, we really helped with a lot of funding. Total recipients going from 27,000 or so to, again, we expected 34,000, ended up serving over 38,000. The new program with variable award sizes has been not just well accepted, but enthusiastically accepted by campus personnel in terms of being able to help students who need more with larger grants, students who need less get the smaller grants. So we are implementing a very progressive program from that standpoint. Now, no one foresaw the economic crisis last fall, nor the resulting enrollment tsunami or application tsunami that I've been talking about. But a parallel trend has been tuition and fee increases at all colleges and universities, but especially at community colleges, some of them increasing faster than that increase in the federal Pell Grant for the neediest students. Now we see, if you remember just a few moments ago, those graphs showing who we will be serving this year, we're scaling back, we're scaling down in the number of recipients, and we will be serving only the neediest students. Will not be able to get up into those middle-class families to assist them this year. The model takes into account, as I said, federal aid, taking the shape of both Pell Grants and tax credits. Again, a timing issue, not available to students or their families till next spring. Very difficult if you're a single independent student. We're expecting you to get a tax credit, but you can't get that cash until next spring, and you have bills to pay this fall. In the next slide here, just show what cost controls are in place. We still have the $70,000 income cap in place, but the actual effect, we're not going to get much above 45,000 or so in terms of the students that we serve. The award caps. We have lots of cost controls in this program, and they're all functioning. The award cap of $2,600 for two-year students, $3,200 for four-year students. Remember, that's both the university system and independent colleges across the state. That $3,200 cap is still in effect, but you can see that the effect of that for this year is, because of the formula, a lower actual cap for those students. Four-year students have a loan expectation. They also, of course, have the same tax credits, the same Pell Grant, that kind of thing. The net effect of that is to reduce their awards. That does spread the funds around. That shows us able to, we think, serve more than 30,000 students this year, but the awards will be lower. The average will be lower. Family contributions to bring this program in budget or in under budget last year, we needed to increase family contributions by about 19%. That is still in effect. What is new this year? We had to shut off awards after August 15. That works, for the most part, very well for students in four-year university or independent college settings. Most of them have to apply in the spring or summer before the academic year starts. Most of them were in the door. In the lower right-hand cell of this graph, I used the figure 5,200. That is now over 6,000. These data were taken from the middle of the month. When we looked at them again last week, we went, again, a jaw-dropping kind of thing. This is going up at the rate of hundreds a day, most of them in the community college sector. Last year, we had to impose a November 30th application deadline. And after that, we had, I think, 7,000 or more applications, again, 90% of them from community college students. What we're seeing is that they have a need. Community colleges enroll students year-round, multiple entry points for programs. No one can plan when a job is lost or a family has a crisis or someone goes back to school because of economic necessity to earn skills or retool or get a new needed credential or something. Those things aren't always planned on an academic year calendar. And we're not able to help those students. Overwhelmingly, it's the community college sector that is impacted. So I wanted you to be aware of what to expect, and I should turn this over to the students in just a moment, but I want you to know what we plan and what we're working on right now this fall between now and the time of the special session in February. We will have actual fall enrollment within another 6 weeks or so, 5 to 6 weeks. And it could take just a bit longer, but by the middle of November, we will know, is this just an application tsunami that contracts rapidly, leaving enrollments similar to last year's level? They were up last year, if you recall. They may be up even more this fall. We'll know that, and we'll know how many students use this award within the coming month to 6 weeks. Big question, then, is retention. We already know that current funding levels for this year and for the 2010-11 academic year will not be adequate to implement the program as designed. That's not surprising. Lots of compromises had to be made. Lots of cuts had to be made to programs. Everyone understands, expects that. The issue now is, where do we go from here? To make progress, it's not just the governor's goals. These are statewide goals, the 40-40-20 goals. We all share them, and all of us in the education enterprise are working toward this end, doing everything we can to get more people into post-secondary education, to help them to get that training and education that we know is so essential to the future of our state. To make progress on that will require more investment. It may not be there. We also know that. It may not be a possibility. We're preparing for an additional request. We all know what could intervene between now and the special session, making this biennium's budget even tighter than it is now. We know that. But we would be remiss if we didn't tell you what the real needs are. So we will be preparing that request, and we'll do it at various levels to show you how many students could be helped if a set amount of funding is available. The bottom line, and I shout it out here in red type, without additional funds, we perhaps will have mid-year reductions again this year. Now, those reductions that we had to make last year were a result of fewer or lower federal funding, lower lottery funds, lower or an across-the-board state reduction. So we, to implement that in the middle of an academic year, the only thing we could do was cut spring semester or spring quarter awards. And we did that, $80 for full-time students, $40 for half-time students. None of us want to do that again. We all realize it may be economic necessity. We do know that for the 2010-11 academic year, the only way we can make these numbers work in projecting ahead is to use very early application deadlines. I've already mentioned to you, the earlier the deadline, the more those recently unemployed, the more those full-need community college students are impacted. So that's a step backward from a program that should be helping students year-round to one that helps only those who get in the door perhaps as early as next spring for the following academic year. That's not a cheery note to end on, but maybe our students can give you a little real-world information.
Thank you, Dennis. Appreciate your realistic assessment. Crystal, if you want to start. Now, we have your written testimony here, so don't feel the need to read this whole thing. If you want to just tell us what this has meant to you without, you know, just giving us the highlights, give us your situation, that's fine.
Okay. Well, Chair Haas and members of the committee, thank you for taking the time out today to chance to speak with you. As you know, my name is Crystal Sandoval, and I am a senior at Western Oregon University, double majoring in sociology and Spanish. I am a member of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition, which is one of the boards that serves on the Oregon Students Association, which serves about 100,000 students. Before Western, I went to school at Woodburn, and I'm proud to say I'm a first-generation student. The Oregon Opportunity Grant has been one of the main factors in my ability to get through college. It makes up for a gap in my affordability and a difference in my ability to go to school. I am fortunate amongst my group of friends because many of them are struggling to receive reductions in their grant or not receiving it at all. Not everyone could be here today on our second day of school, especially those students still determining whether they'll be attending school. So I'd like to give you a little bit more insight about what's happening with them. Many of them are forced to look into getting part-time jobs or full-time jobs as students, which is really difficult. Many of them are seeing textbook prices definitely go up, and that's making it a lot more difficult with costs, especially with the reduction in the grant. Other friends are stressing out because they don't know whether they're going to continue going to school, and that's a really scary thought for them. With tuition increases and aid decreases and cuts to classes and services, we are definitely feeling the cuts. Both of my parents are on unemployment as of now, and like many Oregonians, it's become very hard. And as you know, Oregon is well over the national average with 12.2%. Not surprisingly, at the same time, enrollment at universities and community colleges are skyrocketing. Demand is up, and it's up for a reason. Many of us can see that the biggest investment and return we can give to Oregon is by becoming educated. This is why I'm here to speak with you today. The Oregon Opportunity Grant has been and is making it possible for me to attend the university and to give back more than just with a high school diploma. I know the Oregon Opportunity Grant makes a difference not only for myself but amongst my peers. It can make a huge impact for those who are unable to receive that grant after that August 15th deadline for the FAFSA. If we want to get Oregon back on track, we must continue to prioritize a higher demand and successful programs like the Oregon Opportunity Grant. So as you look for solutions in Oregon's current economic situation, I hope you will prioritize the Oregon Opportunity Grant and Oregon students. We are the generation that will help Oregon get back on track. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Christopher Proudfoot. I am the Director of Legislative Affairs at ASPSU. I'm also the Vice Chair of the Board of Directors for the Oregon Student Association. More pertinent today is that I am also an Oregon Opportunity Grant recipient here in the state of Oregon. I am a non-traditional community college transfer student at PSU. That means I'm returning to college after a time in Oregon's workforce. Like many students, I was not able to afford college right out of high school. My parents are middle-income earners, and they were not able to pay for my college. I was unable to receive financial aid in 2001, the year I graduated, due to an underfunded Oregon Opportunity Grant and its allocation model. My parents were right on the cusp of the income bracket, basically. Despite our financial situation, I was just short of being able to receive any necessary funding to help me go to school. Now at the age of 26, I am able to file independently of my parents. As one of the students mentioned in the presentations earlier that earns far under $20,000 a year, my aid is more important now than ever before. As you probably know, tuition at PSU was increased 8.5%. Now I am at risk, along with many of my classmates, of coming up short this next year. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is a significant part of my financial aid award amount. Without the program, I would be short nearly 35% of my tuition. I depend on the grant to fill the gap between the federal Pell grants I receive, the Stafford-subsidized federal loans that I receive, and my on-campus job. Without this grant, I would simply not be able to afford to continue school and finish my degree at PSU. Excuse me. You have heard from the OSAC presentation that to date there are nearly 5,200, which sounds like it's closer to 6,000, eligible students that have gone unawarded. Moreover, with the cut to the grant to the 09-11 biennium, we are faced with the possibility of mid-year reductions. This means students like me, who have already received their financial aid award letters, will be faced with reductions that will affect us immediately. The Oregon University system explains, and OUS President Ed Ray mentioned in the Oregonian on Sunday, that Oregonians aged 55 to 64 are significantly more likely to hold at least an associate's degree than those who are 25 to 34. At a time when we need innovation and a replacement workforce to get us back on track, we're faced with the possibility of having no way to support students in their efforts to obtain a post-secondary education. Right before the legislative session began in January of 2009, OSAC was forced to set a cutoff date for awarding additional grants because of budget constraints and the high demand on the grant after great 07 funding. In late November of 2008, no new grants were awarded to eligible recipients. Based on that year's budget cuts, OSAC had to set a cutoff date 4 months earlier this year in August 15th. With an earlier cutoff date, I'm sure you can imagine, as well as I can, the difference there will be at the end of this year. With 4 less months available for eligibility, astronomical unemployment, and a major demand on post-secondary education. I am a junior at PSU. I am 2 years away from completing my degree and graduating with a Bachelor of Science in Political Science and a minor in Law and Legal Studies. You have invested in me for the last 2 years, and I am halfway to the finish line. Now is not the time to cut your investment short and turn me and thousands of my fellow students across the state away. Please keep the funding that we desperately need available and allow your investment in us to become an investment in Oregon's future economy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today before you and share our stories and so many other stories of Oregonians just like us in pursuit of post-secondary education.
Thanks to both of you. It's important to all of us, to the rest of the state, that you succeed and get your degrees. And lots of times people don't take that into consideration. It would be bad for us if you don't, if you go sideways here or can't finish or whatever. But Dennis, Chris's situation brings up a point that is, of everything you said, is most disappointing to me, and that is that we're no longer reaching up into the middle class families here. Because his family, when he was out of high school, is in the same boat as, you know, thousands and thousands of families in the state, not needy enough, not wealthy enough. And I had always thought that the notion underlying this concept when it first came up was that there is sort of a progressivity so that we could reach up into these middle-class families. And now we're, as you said, taking a step backward. But I thought even in that situation, we still could make some inroads.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, could we project this slide again? Thank you. What this shows is we will go backwards this year. We will go backwards even more next year. I hope we won't go back to the point we were in the early 2000s, where if you made more than $30,000 some in a family income, you could, you know, if you had a huge family, you could maybe earn in the mid to upper $30,000 range. More than one student in college, maybe you could get a grant. But clearly what we just heard was from a student who was shut out by that kind of a program where family income determined everything. It was all or nothing. You heard the illustration. You even saw it graphed. Those students fell off a cliff, and he fell off a cliff for several years, couldn't get back to school. Last year, look at that tremendous promise of being able to get up into that middle-income range. We're eroding that currently this year, and it will erode even farther next year. Now, Mitigating that somewhat is more federal aid. For the neediest students, they are getting bigger Pell Grants. Middle-income students don't get very much in Pell Grants. In fact, last year, those tall columns showing what happened in 08, 09, there were some families in there that got opportunity grants but no Pell Grants because the federal program was directed toward the neediest students and still is. For tax credits, it's great. I mean, we can defend use of that and the expectation and everything, but as these two students can tell you, tax credits aren't going to help them pay tuition this fall. That will perhaps be a factor for them next spring, if they make it that long. For the students we're shutting out right now, no choice. So the progress we made last year definitely is at risk.
Questions?
Thank you. Dennis, just so I'm clear on your first slide here, these applicants are not necessarily opportunity grant applicants.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, yes, these are opportunity grant applicants. I mentioned earlier, and when people come here and throw numbers at you, you have every right to ask for clarification, and I'm sorry I didn't provide that. I said we get about 250,000 of these federal applications every year, the free form that comes electronically. Of these, we're used to having around, if you look on the far right, the bottom cell there, around 108,000 to 112,000 a year that were good candidates for this program. That means they're Oregon residents. That's the first critical thing. Looking to attend an Oregon school, they're not going out of state. They have to be undergraduates. A lot of those applications come from graduate students or professional programs. And then they have to have eligibility remaining. They can't have had 4 years of the grant already. So what we have, we've gone from 108 to 112,000 candidates. Last year, over 130,000. This year, any way you look at it, it's going to be more than 150,000 viable candidates for this program, not all eligible financially, but all kind of in the queue, as it were, for assistance. We will optimistically serve 32,000, something like that, with all of the restrictions in the program.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you, Dennis. Excellent report. Okay. Let's move on to ESDs. Ozzie Rose is here. And talk about what we need to do immediately, short term, long term. That tortured subject. So do you want to summarize where we are, or do you want us to do that, or do you want to take us where we are and where we're going? Or
actually, I wanted to complain about the drafting over there with all orange and black. You can't trust something that's all orange and black. Either way you want to handle it, Mr. Chair. For the record, though, before time, Ozzie Rose, I reside in Salem, and I represent the ESD Association.
Well,
which issue do you want to attack first?
Well, the immediate short-term problem is the pilot project in three ESDs.
Right. We have a technical problem there, a long-term problem. Yeah, it's
changed its governance model and to being appointed rather than elected, and that sunsets next year.
Correct.
If we don't re-up, they will have to go back.
Right.
So we need to fix that. That's
And a review for you. How the pilot project, or the pilot ESD project that was implemented 4 years ago, where the board members are elected by local school boards rather than by the general public, sunsets this year. In Senate Bill 41, which you amended to 41A and passed through the Senate, there was a provision to create a process for those people to continue. And that language got placed in the merger bill and got lost in that battle. And some of us should have caught on. I think maybe I have some responsibility to that. I discovered it when I was reviewing the bills after you went home. But the situation we've
created, Mr. Chair, for that one.
But I'm only work part-time.
Yeah.
The situation is that the law requires those three ESDs to, between now and the 1st of February, redistrict their ESD, create the new districts, and set up to have an election by the general public. And candidates could apply from February to May, an election in May. The ESDs do not wish to go back to another one. And if you're going to let them stay this way, we're in a situation where they spend a lot of time and money going through the process of redrawing lines, et cetera. And I've talked with all three superintendents, and I've talked to one board. We think you folks should fix this, which you can very easily by taking 41A and passing it while you're here in February. And if we have some assurance that you're interested in going to do that, they could bypass the process between now and February of creating new districts, and then you pass the bill, and then we're all home free. If you don't pass the bill in February, then they would have to really hustle to get that done in time to set up the election process in May. The law specifies they're supposed to do it by February. I don't exactly know how we get around that, except there's no penalty for not doing it. And if everybody operates in good faith, then you're pretty certain we're going to do this. Plan on passing 41A during the upcoming session, and we'll move forward.
And I don't think there's a question. I think it passed unanimously when it went through the Senate.
Yeah, yeah. It was not a problem until it got into the, which, by the way, relates to some of the stuff I'm going to say about the merger question. The merger question overwhelmed it, so to speak.
Right. So I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb by saying that we will do that at a minimum. The question, I think, for this committee and for the legislature is, okay, do we change that appointed governance structure, just kind of re-up for those three, or do we say we're going to do it for all of the ESDs, which starts to add some controversy into it? And then, on top of that, I know the ESDs and the governor's office, there's going to be a work group, talked about doing the big reform in 2011. So in February, is there a bill that sets the stage for that? So there's kind of three versions. There's a technical fix, which I think we can pass unanimously. There's the one that does the appointed governance model to all the ESDs, which is, I don't know where that would go. And then there's also something that sets the stage for the big fix to end this kind of daily headline.
Mr. Chair, I would separate, all those things are on the table, I agree. I would hope that you'd move ahead and tie down this issue for those three ESDs. If then out of the work that is done or going to be done under the reset discussion, governance is different. You could have more ESDs, you have fewer ESDs, you could have regional. There's a lot of things that could come out of that, and governance would have to be adjusted to do that. And if you don't take care of the first issue right now, you put those three ESDs in a significant dilemma. And if you try to expand it and say we're going to make all ESDs do it in February, we'll be, I think, right back in, because that drew a lot of opposition, as you recall. And so I would suggest that we move down the line of getting the three squared away and then talk about the issues in the longer term, quote, fix.
I can't argue with that, although, you know, I'm still reverberating Senator Metzger's comments earlier today that if we're going to be so resistant to change, how in the world are we even going to be thinking about qualifying for some of those reform-centered educational goals? But it's just one man's opinion. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to agree with Ozzie that, I mean, that was, I think we all intended to do that technical fix, and it didn't happen, and I think before the day's over, we can go on record as probably as a committee saying we will draft a committee bill to deal with that specifically. You know I like the new governance model. Mm-hmm. But to do that separate from the other global work we're doing, to go in February and say we're going to change the governance of the ESD structure and then come in a year later and change the ESD structure doesn't make necessarily any sense. So, if we're going to go to a different governance model, let's have the restructure before and do that at the same time. I'm not suggesting that we're attempting to delay this, but I do think I'm very anxious to see what happens between now and February as far as this work group. And because there's some incredible possibilities here and some incredible efficiencies I think we can find in the services we're delivering to kids. And maybe in a more holistic way than we've ever looked at it before. So I'm very excited about the possibilities here. But I do want to make sure that the three groups that step forward to try this new approach don't get penalized for stepping forward to try this new approach.
Okay, so that's, I think, Claire, Senator Bonamici's. Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ozzie, are there other ESDs that are interested in the shared governance model and they're out there saying, well, why wasn't I included in Senate Bill 41, and if only I could be included, I would do this? Or is it just the three that are mentioned in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, not to my knowledge.
Nobody likes change. Mr. Chair, if I could just I'll follow up, because the actual ESD boards don't like it because potentially it's new members on the board and people don't want to give up their positions. So there is an interesting turf issue involved in this.
Can I ask a question of the committee administrator? Is there anything in 41A that would prohibit an ESD, a group of ESDs, from entering into the shared governance model if they all decided to?
Because Senator Bonamici, what we did in 41A is actually provide a process, an optional process. If anyone wanted to convert, we set that out so that they could. But it was not mandatory. It was optional.
Right. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, we also simplified that process vis-a-vis the involvement of the Department of Ed and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it's set up now, so if a local ESD wants to do it, or its districts want to do it, they can launch that without.
Okay, so that's the technical fix.
Yes.
I'm confident we can do that. So that sets the stage for Ozzie, if you will, go forward with where the governor is and where the ESD Association is, moving forward on a larger issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I passed out a paper to you when I first came up here. About 3 months ago, the chair asked me, I was in a discussion on this issue with him, he said, put something in writing. And this is a result of that challenge. And this paper essentially tries to say the issue should not be about numbers of ESDs. The issue should be about creating a infrastructure for regional services for the next 20, 25 years that gets more done for more kids at equal to or less use of resources. And there were six. The ESDs and how to fix them have been periodically before us for the past, I say, 5 decades in this paper, but I think it's probably more like 7 or 8. I'm just not old enough to know about those others. But it comes up every so often, we're going to fix the ESDs. And this last session was no different. You had 6 bills to improve how ESDs work.
All of them had ideas that the sponsors of the bill thought would make things better. We start discussing them, and then we fall into a battle over how many of them there should be or where the boundaries are. And that's not what the discussion ought to be about. Anybody that thinks that things are the same today as they were when we had this set of boundaries set up is that it plain isn't true. We don't fund schools the same way. We have technology we didn't have. We have requirements we didn't have. And to say that we should stay just doing things because we have been is not, it's inappropriate. Now, it may be that you can keep the same boundaries you have and restructure how business is done, or it may not be. Other states are looking at this. There are 10 of them were involved in it last year. Some reduced the number of their ESD, some didn't. They built a different structure within. And so this proposal that the work group would take off on does not upfront say we need to change the number of ESDs. It says we need to build a infrastructure for regional services and do the things that can be done regionally that better serve kids at a equal to or lower cost. And another side of that argument is anybody that thinks this is a problem right now isn't paying attention. Our resource issue is for the foreseeable future. With the growth in demands on the health side, the growth or increase in our age, there's a variety of reasons that there aren't going to be lots of resources to make everybody happy. You need to focus on how are we going to get things done better. Yes, sir.
I would push back philosophically a little bit on it doesn't matter how many we have, because as long as they're licensed and set up with licensed superintendents, there is a substantial administrative cost. And the more you have, the greater the costs. And I'd also push back on the need. To what extent do we need these regional service providers? Has anybody said, do we still need them? I don't think they need them in the larger districts. I honestly don't. I'm not saying that they're not useful and valuable now, but do we need another layer of administration in Portland to perform services that Portland or Corvallis or even Roseburg could do? I seldom see those questions in these kinds of philosophical discussions, which are basically, do we need them in the larger school districts?
Ms. Chair, legitimate question. But I'm trying to argue it comes out of a real honest look at what do regional services contribute to. Multnomah, Clackamas, and one other district, I have a son that's involved in the IT work up there. They're working on a joint effort at doing some stuff with student records, and there are ad hoc things going on, but nobody has addressed specifically how do you best do. What's the best way to see to it that Beaverton has or Portland has what's good for every kid in their area? We have regional services, a set of 8 regions. We have the early intervention, a set of, I'd forgotten, I've got it in there. But the regional concept has value. And it ought to be looked at broader than just what we're currently doing. And we ought not just have a fight over how many there ought to be. And your point is well taken, and it ought to be part of that discussion. But the paper you have before you argues is we ought to build the infrastructure to do what it is we want done. And part of my thinking came from one of your hearings during the regular session. Senator Morris challenged this or asked this question, and because he'd listened to people say, well, this ESD is doing that, and this ESD is doing that over here, over there. And he said if he were doing it, the first thing he'd do is sit down and draw a map of everything that's going on and run it back to where it started and see the current situation. And I took that conceptually to mean let's build an infrastructure based on the need, because the things are going now are based on they do them because they need them. Let's build back from that instead of now. I've said enough about that. Okay, then the next thing, okay, if you want to do that, how do you get it done? And there's a session coming up and all that. I don't think you can build such a thing between now and February that makes dramatic change. And you're going to be so tied up in a budget thing that I don't believe the dramatic kind of change some of us are thinking about can get done in that time. But if we put a work group together and said, you come back to us in February of 10 with a work plan of what you're going to produce and how you're going to go about doing it, and come to us in 2011 with a new a plan for an infrastructure that does what we want done, that is doable. And then the question came, well, how do you get that started? Because you guys can't pass legislation now and so forth. The governor has his reset thing. They're available, and you can get it started that way. In February, if you don't like the work plan that comes out of this work group, you can adjust that. But the point is, we would have a set of instructions that we're looking for the best use of our resources in terms of regional services to all school districts.
And just so the committee knows, we've asked the governor formally to appoint this work group.
It's my understanding that they have made appointments. They're contacting people to see if they will serve. By the way, one other point. The ESD Association, which, by the way, I don't think this is an ESD problem, just an ESD problem. Mm-hmm. Local districts have a huge say in this discussion. So the discussion, the work group, ought not be an ESD work group, and it's brought it up. But I did take this paper to the ESD superintendent's meeting last week, who only two of them had ever seen it, by the way. So there's some license in this discussion. And they endorsed it 100%. And there was one of them absent, excuse me, one person absent, but everybody there. Now, having said that, some of them said, this is different than we were talking about last session. And fundamentally, it isn't. These same things were said, but they got run over by the merger discussion before you could really have this discussion.
Well, that's, you know, potentially what sinks these things is there a grand plan that everybody supports until you find out that this one is going to get annexed into this one. This
right.
is merging.
That's right.
This superintendent's going to lose his job, and this union is going to lose a bargaining unit.
Yeah. But if we model and do things and show that if you were structured this manner, one option in one state they've taken, they left their structure alone, not alone, but they have put five ESDs or some number together and made one of them the lead region for that area. So they've ducked the question of boundaries, but really created instead of whatever they had, they're only three or four. You could do something similar to that on different, you could do it for the technology, create three technology centers. You could do something else with business, backroom business stuff. And if backroom business stuff is done for this group of districts, why couldn't it be done with our computer for a larger group of districts? But somebody's got to model that and talk about it in a rational way, which we never get to do if you just talk about keeping our boundaries where they are.
Chair, Senator Cruz?
A lot of this, and what Ozzy just said, there's a lot of stuff that can be done from anywhere. We know that.
Yeah.
By the same token, for example, I think both maps that we looked at last session combine Douglas and South Coast. One question that was asked of me was, why don't you include Jackson in that? And I thought that would probably make some sense, because it's probably easier to get from Cave Junction to Gold Beach than it is from Roseburg to Gold Beach. But the reality is that for a lot of the services that are delivered, if you're talking about services to autistic kids or the hands-on stuff that has to be done, you can merge all three of those. There's still going to be a field office in Gold Beach because somebody's not going to drive every day from Roseburg to Gold Beach to interact with kids. It doesn't work. The logistics just aren't there. So, I mean, there's kind of two core things here. One of them can be done electronically, but at the base of all this is hands-on services that have to be delivered to kids. And so however you redraw the map, just by the nature of Oregon, the field offices still have to exist. And so, you know, you could eliminate some ESDs, but you're not going to eliminate, or superintendents potentially, but you're not going to eliminate a lot of the structure that is in those field offices, because it has to be there. But these are the things I just don't think we've at any point in time really sat down, if I'm going to argue against the closure of my ESD when it has been proven to me that if we do it this different way, the kids are going to get better services, I don't have much of an argument. So we just need to do it from the bottom up. And these are the best way to deliver the services that these kids need and build the structure based on that. So.
And I don't know if we'd pull this off, but we have quite a number of studies of ESDs, and they're all great, and they're all a list of all the good things they do currently. I don't believe there's ever been a real effort at modeling different ways to deliver their services, and that is what I'm trying to argue we should take on and make a rational decision about changes.
To play this out, this work group is formed, and it sets up a more formal task force work group with a work plan that would require legislation in February to be approved.
I don't know if it would require any or not, but it would come back to you folks for your review, and if they have asked for some legislation, you could do that. If, as you see the review, you say, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't get where I think we ought to go, you can adjust it with legislation at that time. The trouble with trying to get it started through you people only is that you don't come back till November. And so what is being proposed here, let's get it underway. You still have the ways to put your fingerprints all over it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There are filing deadlines and the ability to be light on our feet with a 30-day session or 23-day session or whatever it is we're in for February is somewhat limited.
Yeah, I'm with you. Just, you know, and plus we have a limit on bills we can actually introduce, and so that's where my thinking is coming from. So,
Mr. Chair, the Executive Order 13, if Dana could circulate that to the committee, it would be helpful. I would hope that this process would, I mean, we're kind of, you know, as the legislative branch, we're kind of becoming very disconnected from this process, and I think somehow there needs to be some linkage there. And I'm not just sure how the governor would go about doing that. But.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, too, if maybe that argues for some kind of a bill in February.
And you put it
some kind.
Ms. Chair, maybe the deadline, maybe you put a placeholder. I don't know what to put in it at this point. That's my problem.
Just a ready pause.
Yeah. Because the trouble I had in trying to have these discussions, everybody, is you're not in session now. And so how do you get started?
Relating clauses are easy to write.
All right. Any further ESD questions for Ozzie? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anybody want a really nice schedule, Pac-10 schedule, with all the helmets showing you?
Is that your lottery chart?
Thank you. Where's the committee?
Okay, committee, we're pretty much wrapped up, except for this issue that we were just on, and that is what two bills to introduce for the session as committee bills. I think one of them, it's generally agreed, will be the ESD technical fix. The second one may be that one, but I would hang back for a while, see if there's something more pressing that needs addressing.
Mr. Chair, can I ask, what do you mean by the second one may be that one? You mean creating a task force to look at this with a report back by 2007 just to put them on a schedule?
And I suppose it's within the realm of possibility. Well, I know it's possible we could put that provision into the technical fix thing, but now you're taking it. Now you're messing with a sure thing. But
Do you happen to know, if I may, Mr. Chair, what the status is of this effort to organize the work group to the governor's office? Is that underway? Because
yes, they're appointing people and calling people to see.
Okay.
So I suspect that will be done in a few more weeks. There will be a few meetings over the fall and winter.
And so the purpose of having a bill would be to just
continue it in a more formal.
Give the work group a schedule and a report back.
And I think, you know, they may say, well, we want to work on, you know, what the special needs issues are, what the computer issues are, and we'll say, well, you know, don't do special needs, but do more computer or whatever.
Well, if I could, the reality is that if we think we need a different direction, we can create a work group without a bill. So we can do all the work without having to pass legislation. We can do that. All we got to do is get leadership to agree to a work group, and we can move forward with it. So we can do that without a bill.
Again, I think legislation gives it a little more.
Well, it could, Ms. Chair, quite honestly. But by the same token, I think if we make it quite clear that there is going to be a fix.
Mm-hmm.
In 2011, and we're sincere about what we're saying, I think that carries a lot of weight. So,
well, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To speak to Senator Cruz's comment, if you would reflect on the history of health care reform, you know, much more complex than this, it began with the President's appointment of the Senate Healthcare Access and Affordability Commission that was very, very broad-based in 2005. So that interim in 2005 laid the groundwork that then resulted in specific legislation in 2007 and then resulted in kind of a more finished product, obviously, in House Bill 2009. So, you know, if it's the will of leadership, it can happen.
Right, right. So, I mean, at this point, I mean, you know, if we get close to deadlines and you're feeling like you need something, fine, but
right.
there may be other issues that you might want to address legislatively. I'm not sure what they might be.
What is the deadline, Dana?
November 13th. So it'll be prior to our next hearing.
Right.
So let me hear from you in the next few weeks. Communicate with me or through Dana on issues that you may have. May think, and I'm open to just about everything.
Okay. I mean, you know, February is going to be.
Yeah, these are going to be small fixes.
Yeah, they got to be technical things because I think we're going to have
not a lot of time.
There's going to be other issues, I think.
All right, let's not go down
there. I'll read between the lines on that one, Senator Cruz.
Well. I had hoped that we would adjourn today somewhere around 11:45, and I don't know what time. thank you all. This was an interesting and productive morning, I think. And until next time, we are adjourned.